Hello and welcome to a very interesting episode of the Student Loan Planner podcast. I think people like passive income like they like gold. Passive income, especially real estate passive income, is kind of like finding the El Dorado in terms of what people are interested in knowing about. So that's why I'm really excited to have my friend Chad Carson on the show today. Chad runs a site called CoachCarson.com. He's also the host of the Coach Carson podcast. What do you call it?
Well, you could call it that. It's a real estate and financial independence podcast. That's a mouthful, but maybe people are going to remember Coach Carson as well.
Coach Carson. So they typed in Coach Carson on Spotify or something, they'd find you?
They'll get it. Yep.
Chad is somebody that is actually in this sort of small business group that I'm in. It's kind of fun. That's how we know each other initially. And what blew me away about Chad, I'll let you tell the story about what you did and was it Ecuador for a couple of years and how you did it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a real estate investor by trade, but my wife and I, we have two daughters, one's 8 and one's 10 years old. But at the time they were 3 and 5 years old. And our aspiration, the reason we spent our time investing and trying to make money was to travel. And my wife teaches Spanish. I enjoy learning foreign languages. We love Latin America in particular. And so we moved to Ecuador to a city called Cuenca in 2017 and stayed there. We planned it for a year, but then we were able to extend it longer because we were having a good time and stayed there for 17 months. Our daughters went to school there in Ecuador. They became fluent and started correcting my Spanish, which was amazing, having them do that over the breakfast table, and just had a great time. We love travel, and that's part of our lifestyle that investing allows.
What blew me away is my parents owned a rental property, and it was the most manual, labor-intensive thing in the world. Just a little duplex, maybe made like $800 a month in rent or something. It's like the place where I grew up as a baby, and then they, you know, outgrew it with three sons. And so they rented it out, and we did everything. We mowed the grass. When the leaves fell on the roof, my dad would be like, go get a ladder, get up on the roof and blow this thing off, you know? I mean, just very mom and pop style. And then what blew me away about your story when we met was that you did that Ecuador thing while owning how many units and operating them remotely?
110 between me and a partner. Yeah.
So that's mind-blowing. What I like about your story and what I'm hopeful that our audience will get to hear and learn from you about is there's nothing holding people back from being creative and living life on their terms. We talk about that on student loans all the time. Like, you don't have to pay back your debt just because everybody else is doing it. You don't have to mow the grass yourself at a duplex and put it in the contract that you're going to do that just because you feel like that's what people do. I guess my first question before we get into like lessons for people that they could apply as student loan borrowers to investing in real estate, could we talk a little bit about your, I'm joking around here a little bit, teasing you a little bit, but your unusual background through college to becoming a real estate investor?
Yeah, well, this is very relevant to student debt. And I was very fortunate that I sacrificed my body to be a football player, basically, to pay for my school. It was a lot of fun, though. I played football at Clemson University. I was a linebacker. And if people were listening to this, if they could see me, I'm a pretty skinny guy these days. Like, I might look like a kicker or like a punter or something. But back in the day, I played linebacker, which was like one of the big, strong guys, and was tackling people. And fortunately, that allowed me to get a biology degree and a German minor at Clemson University. And I had it paid for, and I had my car free and clear. So in terms of like, you know, I know a lot of people have different situations. I just feel very fortunate in that respect that football allowed me to do that.
Now, were you good enough that you got any money under the table? It's past the statute of limitations, right?
I never knew that kind of thing was going on, you know, but I did.
But you were like a high level player. Like, you were like an All-American, not just like a bench warmer, right?
Yes. Well, I started for 3 years. And so I was pretty good. I was overachiever. So I maximized my talent. But yeah, I started for 3 years and made a lot of tackles and was an academic All-American and All-ACC while I played there. So I was happy with the result. But then in the end, I actually tried to go to the NFL for a year or two. It was not ever my dream. My dream was to play college football, get a college scholarship. NFL, oh, that'd be nice. But luckily, it didn't work out just for concussion protocols and things like that, that I was able to move on to something else.
My dream to be an NFL quarterback was cut short, so I had to do student loans instead. You know, I'm saying this as someone who never even played Pop Warner, so I'm just totally kidding. But that's really an interesting background, I think, because a lot of people get stressed out about what's next. Like, I certainly felt that way in my undergrad, where I'm sort of like, okay, my whole life, it's been like elementary school, middle school, high school, college degree. And then if you're a good student and everything, you're like, oh, I guess, do I go to law school? Or, oh my gosh, I should do something. So I'm going to go to dental school or med school, right? And I think some people have a calling and know exactly what they're going to do. But you graduated without like a clear path, like not being in the NFL or anything. So what did you do?
I thought my calling was to be a doctor, actually. So a lot of your clients in the medical field, I actually took my MCATs and I applied to a few schools. And then at the last minute, I said, I got to take a break. I'm going to do this eventually, but I got to take a break. And so I decided to be an entrepreneur, which was really, this is interesting, thinking about the motions of it. And I think people resonate with this. The doctor thing was interesting. It was what I knew, it was a secure profession. And I think I would have enjoyed it. But thinking about being an entrepreneur, of like going out on my own as a 23-year-old kid, basically, and just trying to do it was exciting. It got me in my gut. I'm like, oh man, this is kind of like football, you know, like, wow, you know, I could be a climb the mountain and be really good at something. And it was like a personal growth type idea. And then it also had the benefit of being a financial move that, if I learn how to invest in real estate, like maybe I can get passive income. Maybe I can have more flexibility and travel. And there's a lifestyle component of it to it as well. I'm not saying everybody needs to ditch the job and go like do something that's exciting, but I do think following the long-term path of what's exciting and what moves you and you're passionate about is a good aspiration to have that you can kind of attach to financial independence, because financial independence and having a bunch of money in the bank by itself, you know, it's a nice number on a page that'll excite you for a while. But if you have something that's exciting to do and that's the next thing for you, that really gives you an engine, gives you fuel to your fire to do whatever you're trying to do.
Part of it is some people might be interested in real estate and some people might not. And I recognize that. So I kind of want to talk about what somebody that has never owned any real estate before, like what would you advise somebody that's considering trying to buy their first rental property? Like what do they need to be thinking about?
Well, I like how you started this. I mean, a lot of people's stories of real estate are the labor intensive side of things. My father had rental properties, my mom and dad. My mom was a dentist. My dad was like the investing guy. So they were a partnership. My mom would make, you know, good money as a dentist. He would invest it and they managed rental properties. And my dad used to drop me and my brother off in middle school at a house he just bought that needed a bunch of work. And he'd say, boys, I'll be back in 4 hours, clean up this refrigerator. They had like nasty stuff all in it, or cut the grass. I'll be back in 5 hours. And we hated it. Like, we're like, I don't want to do manual labor. Like, we were spoiled, you know, like, let's go play baseball. Let's go play football. And so that was my impression of real estate as well. But I think the thing that people need to know is that real estate can be whatever, just like any business, it can be whatever you make of it. And yes, there's some time up front with real estate. You have to learn the business. You got to learn about how the markets work. But if you're like me, I am not handy at all. And I've never done any of that manual labor. I tried it once and it didn't, you know, I was not as good as the person who could have done it and is more expensive. And so I outsource everything. Like from the very beginning, we have outsourced all physical labor, all contracting work. I focused on the negotiations and I focused on putting financing together to buy properties. And that's where your time is up front in real estate. But once you acquire a rental property, you can outsource the management, you can outsource the maintenance, you can outsource all of that. And you can do it from remotely from anywhere in the world. Like I had just this week, I'm in Clemson where my properties are, but I don't go look at them most of the time. I have a text from my property manager saying, we have this problem with a roof leak. You know, it's over $500, which is our threshold on, they need to call me on it. And I said, my recommendation is to do this. So they told me that here's a contractor. I want to call them. Is that okay with you? I said, go for it. Do it. You know, if they give me give a reasonable bid, just don't call me back. Just do it. So that was like a text. That was not me calling on the phone. That's that bad situation that everybody worries about of having a leak or having something happen. That was my maintenance for the week. And I could have done that in Germany. I could have done that in South America. Could have done that on a cruise somewhere. That's my management of my real estate portfolio.
Well, I mean, like you have the experience, but our listeners, a lot of them have a financing advantage compared to your average person on the street because you've got a legal degree or a medical degree, or you have some sort of really nice W-2 income that banks love and they're giving people mortgages, right? For somebody that's looking to get a second mortgage, maybe they already have a mortgage in their own house, how hard would it be for somebody to get qualified for a second mortgage to say, go buy a duplex as an investment property?
Yeah, there are a lot of loans for investment properties and it's only gotten easier over time. But if you are somebody who has good credit and you've demonstrated you can pay, you know, debt in the past, meaning your credit score is good, and you have a job, a lucrative job, something that can demonstrate that you're making money, it's really easy to get those first few investment loans in particular. So you could buy a duplex, you could buy a rental property, a single family house, even though you have a loan on your first house. You know more about this, Travis, but I think even with a large amount of student debt, you could still have a mortgage on an investment property. In particular, on investment-oriented loans, they look more at the income of the property. There's certain classifications of mortgages. You know, the residential mortgages, the typical ones you think about, they're going to look at your personal income. And so if you have enough income and you have enough income to cover all your debts and have some excess there, you'll have no problem getting a loan. But even beyond that, their investment property loans, they look at the property itself and say, how much income is this property going to make? And if you have good enough credit and the property makes income, you can get loans for those types of properties as well.
I mean, one thing that I kind of like right now is the 30-year fixed rate mortgages are really, really low, right? Like you can get a monthly payment that's really a fraction of what you might think it would be. So could we talk about that a little bit? Like how much debt do you think is smart right now to be taking out given how high the housing market is, but also how low interest rates are?
Yeah, here's the way I look at debt. If you take out a mortgage on an investment property, this is a whole different animal than having a credit card, even having student debt. You know, you're paying that money out. And for student debt, that's typically a good investment if you can also have a high income job that could pay that back. Well, real estate in a respect is like that, in that you're taking a mortgage out on a property. Today, I'm having students in my course who are getting loans at 3.2%, some in the owner-occupant loans, like in the 3% range, low threes, anywhere from 3.5% to 3.75% for investment loans. Just think about it this way. If you can buy a property, and let's just simplify the numbers really in the analysis of a property. Let's say you buy a property that if you had no debt on it, would make a 6 or 7% return from the rent on that property. So it's kind of like a dividend that you buy a dividend stock or some other a CD in a bank. Let's say you invested $100,000 in something and it would pay you $6,000 or $7,000 per year after all of your expenses, after paying a manager, paying taxes, paying insurance. That's what a piece of real estate can do if you buy the right property. So you take that $6,000 or $7,000 and you go borrow money to buy 80% of that property. And let's say you can get a 3.5% interest rate. Even if you borrowed 100% of it, that'd be $3,500 per year. And your property's making $6,000 to $7,000 per year. And if you fix that for 30 years, just think about that. You're making a margin, you know, that $3,000 margin essentially from day one. And then if you extrapolate that, if you're buying a property in a market where inflation tends to happen, which is kind of on the horizon probably for our economy and is already happening, if the rent goes up, if the prices go up, that $3,000 a month is only going to get better and better and better, and you're going to build more wealth and more wealth. And so I think today, even with, you know, people worried about, you know, is the market too hot, all those kind of things, if you can focus on the fundamentals, lock in a 30-year fixed financing at 3, 3.5, make sure you buy a property that's in a good location that also produces enough income to have a lot of coverage, you know, big excess, a big gap between what it costs you to buy the property and what you're generating in income, that's a really solid plan. I mean, it's hard not to make money on that plan.
Well, I like what people that invest in what they understand. So, I mean, I guess one thing you could say, yes, the real estate market's super hot right now, but it's not necessarily blazing hot everywhere, right? Like I would imagine like townhomes, maybe apartments in certain kinds of cities, duplexes, quadplexes, things that are not single family homes, I would imagine give pretty good yields right now. How do you think about that when you're choosing what property to buy? Do you lean in more towards single family homes or do you try to go for more multifamily kind of units?
I do both. I'm kind of agnostic in terms of which type of property I like. I like residential. I like small residential. Most of my 110 units are smaller houses, duplexes, fourplexes. We have a 12-plex. I find that's the most conservative real estate you can buy because there's this idea that no matter what happens in the economy, probably people are going to have a place to live. Like even in the Great Depression, I imagine sometimes, like what would happen in a Great Depression? Well, people still have to live somewhere. They might not have enough money. Like maybe they have to trade me chickens and eggs for my rent, or maybe they'd come paint my house for rent. But like having a residence is a very solid conservative product to own as an investment because people need to rent it. And so that's one reason I choose residential property, whether single family, duplex, quadruplex, whatever. But then the other thing you want to look for, I really like, you know, looking at the local market. Real estate is not a national market. It's very localized, like you were talking about. I like looking at smaller cities on the edges of big metropolitan areas. So you're in the Raleigh, you know, Durham area. I like the smaller 100,000 person neighborhoods or cities, you know, outside of those big metro areas. So you have a research triangle, you got all these people coming there for jobs. Find the metropolitan area that feels like a little small town, but it's got enough of an epicenter. It's like almost like a planet that's going around the sun or something. Find those little planets, those little moons around the big cities that have a lot of good things going for them, but they're also a little bit more affordable than if you were to buy in a big city. Like if you go buy San Francisco, New York, you know, Manhattan, those are extremely high prices. But if you go 45 minutes to an hour outside of the city. I have people I know who are buying vacation rentals, you know, within an hour or two of New York City. I know people who are doing the same thing in Charlotte, Atlanta. So the smaller cities you get, that's not saying it's going to be easy to find a deal, but it's just going to be more reasonable on the rent to price ratio. There's not so much money internationally like they have in the big cities. There's money from all over the world buying in New York City, and they don't care about the yield on the rent on that property. They just want to make sure their money doesn't go away. They're looking at it much differently than you and I, a small investor who wants to get some growth, but we also want to have some income to use to pay our debt down and to do other things.
That's a great point that you make. Like I kind of read some article in the journal a few months ago that was sort of talking about like, why do New York real estate properties sell for so much money? And one of the reasons that they gave was that, you know, a giant institutional investor like an insurance company will want to put to work $500 million in real estate. And the best way to do that is just to go buy a skyscraper in New York and rent it out to commercial tenants. And that's just because it's easy, it's scale, but that really affects valuations of these kinds of units. So I would expect something similar would happen, like you said, in New York, San Francisco. A lot of rich people put their money to work, some legit, some not legitimate, right? Like people that are sort of, almost kind of like maybe laundering money from abroad. Like, what's the best thing to do? Go buy a penthouse apartment in New York City, right? So, I mean, maybe in a less extreme example, maybe, somebody who's wealthy that wants to buy something that's going to hold its value, they might buy in like the downtown, some really expensive unit. But maybe you're saying if you go a little bit out of the way, someplace, maybe there's not as many ultra rich people that would want to visit this town or pay attention to it or something, you might be able to get a decent deal.
Yeah. You want to follow jobs. Like that's, I think that's one of the main compass points you want to keep oriented towards in real estate is follow jobs. So you want places where if you look at the median income for that area, if you look at what the median rent is, and you can study this on Zillow, for example, or there's some other websites out there just for free. That's one of the great things about the information age. You can find all sorts of statistics about a local area very easily now. But if you compare the median income of an area to the median rent, and if that's pretty similar, if that's within line, and typically like when I'm qualifying tenants, I want to make sure that about a third of someone's income could pay for the rent on that property. That's a basic way. So if they make $3,000, they could afford barely $1,000 per month. If they make $6,000, they could barely afford $2,000. And so you can sort of look at affordability of a town and then study where the jobs are. And this doesn't have to take a long time. You can do this in 30 minutes to an hour. Just study, what are the major industries in my area? Is it diversified? Like my town's a little bit more risky. We have one big university and that's it. Like there's no other industry in Clemson. That's it. That's a little bit more risky. And so we should be able to get a little bit more of a premium because of that than compared to buying in Charlotte or Atlanta, which are 2 hours from me, which are much more diversified economies with different types of jobs. Charlotte's a banking center. Atlanta's all sorts of different industries there, tourism also. Big cities are one of the best things to invest in because if you think about it, they're a network effect. Network effects are like you think about Facebook, you think about some of these big, huge companies these days. That's why they're so valuable is because there's so many people connected by this thing they're using that it becomes more and more valuable the more people get into it. And cities are the same way. Cities are the ultimate long-term ancient network effects that have been going on for a long time. And so you want to benefit from those big city network effects, but you want to also buy it on a budget. And that's why I say suburban areas or even area, little small towns, historic towns. I grew up in a town called Noonan, Georgia, outside of Atlanta. It's 35 minutes from Atlanta, but it's got its own little identity, its own downtown, its own economy in some respects. That's what you're looking for. And that's my opinion on some of the best opportunities today.
So, I mean, it kind of seems like what you should be doing strategically is reinvesting in the football program at Clemson to try to generate additional student interest in the university to increase the price of your rentals. Is that, a strategy you're employing?
Yeah, I need to like go make sure these guys are playing well and winning more games so we can attract more students,
This is a podcast for student loan borrowers. One thing that I've been asked a lot about or I've seen people talk about is the professional real estate investor status. And this is something that for people that are unaware, basically the idea is you've got two spouses. One of them is really into their job and making a lot of money. And one of them is like kind of into their job, but not really. And they really wish they could be doing something else or at least working, a lot fewer hours. And as I understand it, one of the two spouses basically spends the quote unquote majority of their working hours on real estate. And then you can take all of the losses you generate on a home and then deduct it from the person who's working's active taxable income. And what you might say, well, why would you lose money? That doesn't sound like a smart investing strategy. Well, obviously, if you buy a rundown duplex and then you replace the kitchen, you replace the toilets and you invest in it to make it nice enough to rent out, those are the paper losses that go actually cause your equity in your home to increase, where you would actually get a positive return for that. We have people in California that use this strategy that get their taxable income down from like $500,000 down to like $50,000. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could share a little bit if you've ever use that strategy yourself, or if you've heard of people using that strategy, what do people need to know about it?
Yeah, it's a great strategy for certain people who had this situation, which is a lot of your listeners. And I have not done it because of my personal situation where my wife worked as a professor, but then she went part-time and we traveled. And so we actually didn't make enough active income that it made sense to be a professional investor, and actually didn't want to work that much. So we never met the qualification of a professional investor, but my parents did that. And so I'm very familiar with the situation. And it was, let me tell their story, and I think it'll be relevant to a lot of people listening. So my mom was a dentist, and you know, those numbers that you talked about are very similar. You know, let's say they make $500,000 per year, and then you go and buy some real estate. Real estate, one of the biggest benefits of it is that it has paper losses. Like you said, these are losses that you don't necessarily write a check for. Like typically you think about an expense. Okay, I've got a tax expense on my property taxes, or I have insurance. You write a check to the insurance company, you write a check to the county for that tax. Well, this paper loss, you actually get to call it an expense on your taxes, but it's really just taking the purchase price you had for the property plus any improvements, and it's allocating that over like a longer period of time. So let's say 27 and a half years, for example. And so you're dividing out the purchase price that you already spent money on, and you're dividing that out year by year and calling that an expense. Now, why does that matter? It matters because you can shelter income, and that means you can protect it from being taxed. And let's just go a real simple example. Let's say you had $5,000 in rental profits, and you had this rental property that had $5,000 in depreciation loss, which is what we're talking about there. That $5,000 in depreciation loss, which you're not writing a check for, right? That's going to offset that $5,000 in rental income you have, and you will not pay any tax on that rental income today. There are some things we'll talk about down the road. So that's one aspect of it that anybody can do, whether you're a professional real estate investor or not. It can offset your rental income if you have a loss. But here's where the professional investor kind of takes it to another level. Let's say you had $10,000 in depreciation losses, which is very possible if you're buying properties with leverage, if you're buying them and you know, for a higher price. And this might make sense if it's a property that's going up in value a lot, you're buying in a good location. Well, you have a $10,000 loss and you're making $5,000 in rental income, and you have that excess loss of $5,000 that if you're not a professional investor, you actually can't use that to offset your other income. So even if you made $100,000 over at your active job, you cannot use that. There's some more complicated rules than we probably want to get into that you and your CPA could help you do, but you would have to carry that forward. That loss would not be usable right now. But if you're a professional investor, so let's say you make $500,000 a year and your spouse decides, hey, I like real estate. I'm going to be a real estate agent or property manager. I'm just going to manage our 15 units that we have. And you spend the minimum amount of time to do it. So look up the rules for that. Then you could take that $5,000 loss and you could offset that against your $500,000 of active income. And let's extrapolate that. It's not $5,000, maybe it's $400,000 worth of depreciation. And that's what my parents did. That's what a lot of medical professionals have done in those situations, and totally legitimate. You know, they really do, the spouse really does have a job that they're spending time on, but it unlocks that potential now. And if you think about the tax rates for people making $500,000 a year, we're talking in like the 40% range, right? Or somewhere in there, 50% almost sometimes with state taxes. And so you're saving big time tax money in the short run that you can reinvest and use that money to buy more wealth.
Chad, all I'll say is I wish I could be as smart as Jeff Bezos and figure out how he pays zero. I mean, yeah. I'm very much not paying zero. My dad sort of makes jokes about it all the time. My dad's a teacher. So, you know, he's like, oh, you know, Travis, thanks for funding the services, my pension or something, you know, I don't know. But that's interesting though, because you make that point and it's like the tax code is super messed up. Like we all know that, right? Like the tax code is very unfair. It's not at all something that is something we can be proud of.
No.
But it is what it is. Same thing like with student loan rules, right? So do we wish that student loan rules were different? Should, you know, some folks have their loans canceled? Should people have simpler options, less interest growth? Like all those things, I think you can say that'd be great, but that's not the system that we have. And therefore, we just have to operate with the system that we have and do the best we can. And this is a huge opportunity. One of our friends just did this. I think the wife's a pediatrician. The husband's a partner in an orthopedic surgery practice. He makes a ton of money. She, you know, was getting paid like academic pediatrician income, which is not a whole lot, right? And so what she did is cut her FTEs, I think, down to 0.5 or less than that, and then spends the majority of the time on the real estate. And now they are able to invest in their properties, improve them, and knock his taxable income down just to an absolute fraction of what it is.
Yeah, that's such a great story. And just think about what this can do for your life. Like whether you want to continue working for the next 10, 15 years or not, if you can save an extra $250,000 per year, That is an amazing cheat code. You know, like if we're talking video games here, that's something that's a game changer. Like, let's just say you invest $200,000 extra for the next 5 years. I mean, man, you've now invested an extra $1 million that if you invested at 7% interest, you can run the math. Like, that'll turn into $2 million before long. And if you add that to what you're already saving, this now gives you financial independence much earlier in life just by using one strategy, like just like that.
Well, like to talk about who this strategy is good for, like we could also say just more broadly, real estate, I think, could be for a lot of people. Like, I don't think it's for majority, but I think that for the people that are interested in it, it's life-changing because I really advocate index fund investing. That's what I am comfortable with. That's what I like. I think it requires the least amount of time, that offers great returns long-term, you know, invest what you know, right? But I will say this, talking about football players for a second, one of my favorite players was Percy Harvin back in college, super electric player. Played for the Minnesota Vikings, you know, just touchdown threat waiting to happen, made good money, didn't have a super long career, but had a decent enough career. And one of the things I think that I've read recently, why you haven't heard his name negatively in the news from a, you know, oh, this guy's broke kind of story, which you see often, is he just took most of all of his money and just paid cash for a bunch of rental properties. And that was his strategy. It was just, okay, I'm going to take my, you know, X amount of money and I'm just going to buy whatever rental properties I can buy with that. And then whatever the income is after expenses that hits my bank account, that's what I'm going to live on. And if, you know, with the rising value of those properties, he can probably do a cash out refinance if he ever needed to access extra. But he knew himself and he was like, okay, if I buy, you know, X amount of rental properties that yield good income, well, I'm going to have all these depreciation allowances and things that'll save me money on taxes. And then I can take that $500,000 and live on it for the rest of my life. Right. So I think that for people that are interested in real estate, the example that we gave of the orthopedic surgeon and the pediatrician is an extreme one.
Yes.
You know, we recognize that the average person listening to this podcast might be a teacher married to a police officer, right? Or a lawyer married to a social worker, right? Not somebody that's necessarily making six-figure earners. So I want to emphasize too that this is something that you could do not as a six-figure earner, as a five-figure earner. So let's say you're a five-figure earner and you're interested in buying a real estate property. You talk about the A, B, C, D properties, and you talk about certain kinds of ones to target. Maybe you could walk through an example for somebody who's, you know, a five-figure income household that wants to get involved in investing about that.
Yeah, and most people are in that camp. Like most people I did a survey of my audience. I know you do this with your audience as well. And most people listen to my podcast, for example. I think the average is $90,000 somewhere in there for income. And so that's most of the people that I help. But I do want to say, like, think about when you're investing and building wealth, you got to go with what your strength is. And there's people who make $500,000 a year. I love your NFL example. They should just keep it simple. Like your engine, your number one asset when you're making $500,000 a year is that you make $500,000 a year. Don't get fancy. Like just going and paying cash for a bunch of real estate, I think is super smart. Like I say, ignore all the optimizer people who say, oh, you got to borrow debt and do all this stuff. Like I think you could just go pay cash for stuff. And I've seen tons of people do that who make a lot of money. So that's on one extreme. But let's go to the other end. Somebody who makes $50,000 or $70,000 or $90,000 a year, that's solid money. But the issue is going to be is like if you want to get financial independence, if you want to build this big nest egg of wealth, you've got to make more money or you got to save more money. Like you've got to spend less or make more. Those are your only two ways to make more. If you're kind of stuck on your income level, one of the best ways to save money is looking at your personal residence, where you live. And so I'll talk about a strategy called house hacking. House hacking just means that you look at your residence a little differently than most people do, at least for a period of your time in your life. Like you don't have to do this forever, but let's say for like a 5 to 10 year period of your life, buy a house that has an apartment over the garage, or you turn the garage into an apartment, and then you rent that out on Airbnb, for example. I know people who make, you know, $1,000 a month, $2,000 a month, just renting one Airbnb out on their residence. Or maybe you have a basement apartment that you could turn into an in-law suite and, you know, rent it out on Airbnb or rent it long run and then have your in-laws come in every once in a while as well. That's actually what my wife and I have done. We rent out Airbnb game day rentals at our house. But then you could also even go more aggressive. Maybe you could buy a duplex or a triplex or a fourplex, which is how I got started when I wasn't making much money. I rented out the other three. I actually paid for 100% of my housing expenses. And the average housing expenses for people in the US is about 30%, sometimes 40% of your income goes to housing. This often works earlier in your life, but I know people who go kind of downsize from a big house and go to one of these houses as well. If you can figure out some way to generate income from the house that you live in, then you can save more money. So if you're limited in your income, you've now cut, you know, 30% or 40% of your expenses. You can invest that money and you can put it in index funds. Like, it's not an either or thing. Like, I love index funds as well, and I invest in real estate and index funds. So doing a house hack, getting into the game, maybe you only have one or two properties, you know, the house you live in, plus this one rental that you used to live in and you kept it as a rental property later on. This can be a very small game. And in fact, most of the people I'm talking to on my podcast, I use this quote that you can have a small and mighty real estate business and be just fine. Like, you do not have to have 100 units. You do not have to have 1,000 units. You don't have to build this big empire. Having two or three properties and just getting them paid off one of these days can supplement your retirement or help you retire earlier or allow you to work part-time because it makes you an extra couple, $2,000 or $3,000 a month that you wouldn't have got otherwise. That's a beautiful thing.
It is. One thing I like about your book, Retire Early with Real Estate, one of the things it says is figure out what your goals are. Like, in other words, don't just be like, oh, I want to own 100 units. Well, that's not specific. Maybe a good goal is, well, I want $80,000 a year of passive income where my family can have minimal work with that and then just enjoy a really great quality of life. Then you're probably buying, I don't think we got into the ABCD properties, but you know, you're probably buying properties with less of a likelihood you're going to have tenant problems that are not top dollar where you're overpaying for it, but still in decent enough neighborhoods. And then you, maybe you say, okay, I need $80,000 a year to make the math easy. Let's say that one decent unit gives you $10,000 a year of free cash flow after expenses or something, right? After all expenses, you net $10,000. Well, then you need 8 properties, right, to be financially independent and be able to live off of that passive rental income. So how long does it take you to get to 8 rental properties? Well, maybe you buy the first one this year. Maybe you buy 2 the next year if the conditions are still good. Maybe you could get to that level of income, you know, much faster than you might be able to get to it through straight up saving and index funds, where to generate $80,000 a year of income, you probably need to invest $2 million.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why balancing rentals with index funds is a really smart strategy. I own index funds because I believe long term that businesses in the United States, for example, are going to do really well reinvesting my money and they're going to grow well. Like, I have confidence in that. But when you have to live off your income, stocks are a little bit less ideal. You have to sell them typically to be able to live off of them, which is not a problem over the long run because they tend to go up in value. What I love about real estate is if you complement your index funds with that, is you can build an income floor like you just talked about, like whether it's $5,000 a month, $8,000 a month, $10,000 a month, you build this income floor of very solid rental properties. These aren't, you know, really low-end properties or anything. You can build, we call ABC, like A is the best neighborhoods with the most expensive properties. D is like the worst neighborhoods, usually older, they're run down, there's a lot of crime. And then in between there, you'll find like blue collar working class C neighborhoods are in that category. And then B neighborhoods are kind of in between. And I find a lot of the lower hassle long-term, like single family house rentals are in that C plus, B minus kind of area. If you buy 8 of those, that could be an extremely part-time job. Going back to my experience in Ecuador, I worked, you know, 30 minutes to 60 minutes a week with 110 units. So if you have a property manager helping you out with 8 properties, that's going to be a very, very part-time job. It's going to produce that income floor you can depend on for a long time. And then you can supplement that with your other investments for growth and for diversification at that point.
Yeah, like, I mean, if my parents had invested at scale, like, I think their strategy would have been pretty good. Like, because they had, it was like a neighborhood that planes flew over. It was kind of near the airport. It's not super nice. Like, everything was a duplex in the whole neighborhood. But at the same time, like, fairly quiet, not too many issues. And, you know, the people that would tend to rent from them would be like an x-ray technician at the hospital or like a manager, you know, at the enterprise. You know, some sort of like good, solid job that's like probably upper working class in terms of salaries. But, you know, I guess one thing during the pandemic, and this is more of just like a pure sort of investor analysis of this problem, but obviously we had a big problem where a lot of people couldn't afford their rent. And so you had a lot of eviction moratoriums around the country to help with that, which caused a lot of these downstream issues where I think in the C and D properties, especially, a lot of the articles that I read were sort of like the people that were landlords were often like not super wealthy themselves. Like, this was their route to go become financially independent because they could never afford an A or B property, but they could get into that C or D property and grow wealth. But the problem is it's so stressful because it's like you're dealing with folks that also have economic insecurity. And I think that the goal is to, like, if you're a real estate investor, is what are your goals? One of those goals should probably be to minimize the stress and the hassle and the worry. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess that's something that you might have taken into account with your investing strategy, I suppose?
Well, I mean, there's a caveat there too. Like, yes, that's generally true that there is some more hassle the lower you go down. And it's a travesty. It's a problem in our society that housing is so unaffordable. Like, right, you know, somebody makes $1,200 on their fixed income retirement account and they're trying to pay $600 for rent. You know, like that's really, it's impossible almost. And so that is a problem. Although I know landlords who rent in the C minus D areas and they do Section 8 rentals, for example, they had zero concern during the pandemic because the federal government was not only paying their rent, they were trying to increase that program and pay more. So actually some of the safest houses are in the lower price ranges, because if you were to own an A or a B plus property, it's like a, you know, a bigger house and a nicer neighborhood. In an economic calamity, those people are going to go down to the C neighborhoods because that's what they can afford. And whereas the lower price properties almost never go vacant. Like if you had an affordable rental, there's millions and millions of people who can afford your rental. And so there's very little vacancy there. And I had a mentor who used to tell me, like, Chad, it's hard to fall off the floor when you're on the floor. It's like that's where you are when you own lower price properties. So that's the benefit of that.
Makes sense.
But you want to find a happy medium. You want to get the benefit of that floor-like rent level. Typically, the lower price properties are older. They have more hassle in terms of maintenance. And so I think that's more the issue than the tenants, is that you have these really old properties that are run down, and people usually underestimate the amount of cost that's going to be. Like if you have a 50 to 80-year-old plumbing system, those pipes are going to start busting. You know, if you have a old drain pipe that's in this old property that, you know, is not worth that much, you're only getting $600 in rent. Your sewer line needs to be replaced for $5,000. Like that's unaffordable. You don't really make money on properties that have really low rent with really high expenses. And so I think that's more the challenge of the low price properties, because you can find great tenants in there if you can afford to make the numbers work.
But I think the key thing is specialized, like just like my personal story. I was successful with Steel Loan Planner because I stopped talking about everything and I narrowed it down to just focusing on the folks that are listening to this podcast that have student loan debt, especially debt over $100,000. And so instead of trying to talk to the entire world of 300 million Americans, I'm talking to 3 million.
Yep.
Right. And so that's still a huge group of people because it's growing exponentially every year. Right. But at the same time, it's a more narrow slice in this broad spectrum of opportunities. So I would say if you're interested in real estate, I would try to learn your concepts and then apply them to like that particular area that makes sense to you. Like, you know, when you're talking about the lower price properties, I have a buddy who went to Wharton and was doing this fancy job and then, you know, realized, wait a second, you know, what I really enjoy is like working in these lower priced homes and lower priced communities. And so he works with the community to work with like a local property manager that understands the neighborhood. And then he is good with the models. And so he looks at all those maintenance expenses and just plays law of large numbers. So he knows if he can find 100 houses to buy in the poorest neighborhoods of Detroit, he's going to have X number of pipe replacements, X number of whatever. And then he's able to make that cash flow work by hiring people to fix them up and rent them out. And then I think has really good relationships with the city government where they recognize him when he's putting in for like a tax foreclosure auction or something like that. I think that's the thing that really sticks out to me is like you found out the strategy that works for you, kind of more of a localized strategy that's got a lot of margin and it's got not a ton of debt leverage that you're using. So it's a fairly safe strategy. And maybe for our listeners, maybe a slightly a different strategy, right? So, oh, and one point too from earlier, you mentioned house hacking. One of my friends just is really handy and he moves into a house and fixes a bunch of stuff up in the house and then relists it every 2 to 3 years. Obviously, both spouses have to be on board with this. My wife, I told her this strategy. She's like, yeah, that's hilarious. You can move by yourself as often as you'd like, you know. But if both spouses are on board with that, then, you know, you can get, I think, what is it, up to $500,000 tax-free by selling your house if you live in it the past 5 years. Is that right?
Yeah, it's one of the best parts of the tax code. So yeah, we call it a live-in flip in the real estate world. But you live in it for 2 years out of the last five. You sell it. Whatever gain you have on there is tax-free, up to $250,000 for an individual. So if your wife does make you move out, Travis, you can still get $250,000. If she happened to move with you, you could get up to $500,000. So
sounds like a deal. I get $250,000 tax-free, but I lose half my assets, right?
Yeah. No,
I'm just kidding. But it's a great idea though, if you happen to like that stuff, right? Because you know, you can hire a plumber for, I think, $250 a toilet to replace your toilet, or you can go learn how to do it if you're so inclined and you enjoy that. And so you go to Lowe's or Home Depot, if that's like a hobby of yours, you buy like a halfway decent toilet, right? And you install them and you, like I said, change out the stuff in the kitchen, maybe put in luxury LVP, luxury vinyl flooring. If you can learn how to do that, if it's pretty straightforward, I'm not sure that it is. I would never attempt it, but if you happen to be handy.
Yeah, there's people out there. I think the point is like find your strength. Like if you're handy, like there's opportunity for you in real estate. If you're a spreadsheet cruncher, there's opportunity for you in real estate. If you're good at sales and negotiation, there's opportunity for you. And that's, I'm not saying I'm good at that, but that's more the angle I took. I was good at negotiation, or I learned how to be good at negotiation, just being a, you know, just a regular person. It wasn't like trying to schmooze people. If you're willing to go out and talk to people and walk neighborhoods and, you know, call signs, and there's tons of hidden opportunities out there. You just have to be willing upfront to put in some learning time. And that's the caveat. Like, I'm going to sell people on not doing real estate. The time you have to invest in learning it upfront is more like a business. It's more like a startup when you first begin it. But there's a payoff. Like, it's almost like there's, that's the dues you have to pay to get into real estate, because in the end, it's very little work. My parents have a lot of free and clear real estate. They spend very little time on it. And I spend very little time on the day-to-day management of it. That's the decision you have to make for yourself. Like, if you are such a busy, if you and your spouse or just you yourself are so busy, you don't even have 30 minutes to think about this, this is probably not the right time for you. Like, maybe plant the seed and say, all right, if I get 5 hours a week that I can do, you know, talk to some people, or if I can get a partner, somebody I really trust who can go do the operating of the business and I can be an investor with them, you know, that's another business model. But you just have to know what your strengths are and what your personal abilities are at the moment, and then choose if this is something you want to do or not.
But there's plenty of people that could do this for more flexibility in their lives, right? Like, some people out there are going to look at this as like the fun side hustle that they do to take their mind off of fixing people's teeth or doing people's wills or business transactions or something, or patients, whatever. And then other people might say, well, you know, I've got 2 or 3 kids. Maybe if I can't find remote work and I want more flexibility and something that's interesting to me, well, you could be the professional real estate investor and spend most of your time working on that, while your spouse has got all the student loans and needs to lower their taxable income for purposes of getting loan forgiveness, you could help write off their income for them by fixing up a bunch of properties that you're going to have financial independence from. So I think it's really exciting for me. My specialty, I think, is student loans, right? Which is why I have not gotten involved in real estate and don't plan to, unless I were to ever get forced into selling a student loan plan or something like that, that I wouldn't probably want to get super involved with it, just because for me, I know my strength is like going and trying to find another product line, like practice loans for dentists, veterinarians, and physicians, where, oh my gosh, the typical practice broker or, you know, person sending people to a bank, it's like a 1% fee on a practice. Like, oh my gosh. And instead of doing that, like, you can rebate like $1,000 to somebody like that nobody's doing. That's, to me, is a kind of exciting where I think I add value. And by the way, we're doing that. If you look at Student Loan Planner in the marketplace menu, you're looking for a practice loan, go to that, because we've got a bunch of partner banks now, kind of like the student loan refinancing cash bonuses. But figure out what you're good at, figure out what you like, and figure out if you're in a relationship or you're married, like what your spouse or significant other might like, and see if this is something that you want to be, have it be a part of your portfolio. And I think, just like there's 17 different kinds of loans that you can consolidate, Chad, there's probably at least 17 different kinds of ways that you can invest in real estate, maybe lending to people, doing hard money lending, or finding deals for people, or doing, you know, syndications and stuff. Like, do you want to mention just like 5 off the top of your head, different kinds of investing in real estate?
Yeah, sure. I actually read an article, which I'll give you, we can link in the show notes, that I think it's like 25 different niches, whatever, however you pronounce that. I'll just list 5 off the top of my head. 2 we've already talked about. 1 is just single family houses in like a B nice neighborhood, long-term buy and hold rentals. Like, that's one way of investing in real estate, very passive. You could do lower end, like Section 8 type rentals. That would be another little niche, and you'd want to look for lower price properties. You could do loans to other people. So I've done this. This is more what I'm doing lately, actually, is I'm not doing as much buying new properties, but I find a builder locally who's building houses, and I loan the money to that builder to build those houses. And if everything, you know, went bad, I would take that house back and I would rent it out. And I know the location, I know the price range. So that's another way I see a lot of people who have capital, either their own capital or sometimes retirement account capital. Like, I've loaned money from my self-directed retirement account, which is a whole nother story, but they have custodians who allow you to invest in real estate or make loans or do limited partnerships. So that's 3 right there. I also know Airbnb is a kind of a niche for people that's very popular right now. And I mentioned probably my favorite way to do it is just do it kind of on the side as a side hustle, and find an extra bedroom, an extra apartment, things like that, and rent it out. That's another one. And I'm trying to think of some of the other more popular ones. Doing syndications is, from a passive investment standpoint, is not something I've done a lot of, but I know people who do it, where you find, and here's the key word, you find an operator or a syndicator who you trust. That's going to be the due diligence work you're going to have to do up front. Find somebody you trust who's actually going and building a big apartment building or something, or building some rental properties. And then you go invest your money as the money partner with that person. That's an opportunity. You need to do your due diligence on that. But there's people who make a lot of money doing that, and they might make you know, a good return and make some dividend or some rental income without them having to be the one actively doing the work on the property. So there's five just off the top of my head.
That's great. There's a lot of platforms now that people can participate on and do syndications. I'm a little bit more hesitant on those just because I know, like, my big question is always liquidity. What happens when we don't have a market that's on fire where, you know, you've got just everything at such high valuation levels that you need to get your money out, things fall apart. And that's the scary thing about real estate. If you're not paying attention to the numbers, is the people that have just made money hand over fist by not even paying attention are going to get burned the next recession. But people that have their head on straight that are following like long-term principles, I think are probably okay. Do you think?
Yeah, I think my recommendation, whether you do especially if you do a syndication, that the thing that is risky that I agree with you on is if you don't understand real estate at all, and then you go invest in a syndication, I'm a little hesitant on that because you're going to need to analyze the business and the decisions they're making, the assumptions they're making. One of the biggest assumptions that has happened a lot lately is people are like, oh, well, 2 years from now, we'll fix up this property and sell it, or we'll refinance it, get all our money back. We're going to refinance it at 3% interest. Well, what happens if the interest rates are 5%, you know, and we're going to sell it at a 4% cap rate, which is just a way to value a commercial property. Well, what happens if the cap rates are at 5%? And all these assumptions they make behind the scenes, typically for a lot of syndicators, they're going to be on the optimistic side, right? They're going to make them look good. And so what I would recommend is understand the fundamentals of just buying a house, like doing it yourself. Even if you don't do it yourself, like study the fundamentals. And if you do a syndication, then apply those same fundamentals and ask those questions to the investor. And what I would ask the operator is like, what happens if we have to hold this property for 20 years? What do my numbers look like then? And if they can help you run through that and it's a reasonable return, it's not going to be as high as it would be otherwise, but if you can still make a 10% return, you know, with reasonable leverage and with a long-term horizon, then you can make a decision on that worst case scenario instead of the best case scenario.
That's great. So like what I like to tell people when I'm on other podcasts and talking about my area is if you want to know more about student loans, like there's a lot more, check out my podcast. Same thing here. If you've listened to this show and you're like, oh my gosh, I would love to write off all of my wife's income or all my husband's income with being a professional real estate investor, or learn the 25 types of real estate investing, or buy my first property as a five-figure income household, where should people go to find just a ton of free content?
I think the best place is if you're listening to a podcast here, I have a podcast every Monday, and that's where a lot of my community kind of hangs out. I have so if you look on any podcast app and look for Real Estate and Financial Independence podcast, or just type Coach Carson, you'll find me on Spotify, Apple, all of those. Every week, I'm typically talking to regular investors who are just trying to do what we're talking about today. So I like talking to my students and people in my audience and interview them, but also interview other people who have some expertise. For example, we might talk to CPA who gives us advice on those high income earner kind of situations, or I talk to, you know, retirement account specialists who specialize in retirement accounts for investing for real estate. So if you just want to go deep on that, that's what I do every week. I have conversations. I also have a YouTube channel, which I'm working a lot on lately. If you want more of that, the tutorial side of things, like how do I do this? Or what's the story? And I draw on a little whiteboard and explain things and how to run the numbers, how to do things visually. So I'm getting a lot of traction on the YouTube channel. So if you're a YouTuber, check that out as well. And we'd love to connect with you there.
With you being a former All-American linebacker, I've always said that, you know, you should be a lot sketchier with your marketing yourself, like, you know, take down single family homes like I took out FSU linebackers or running backs. See, I don't even, I messed it up. If FSU, you know, destroy this like house flip, like I blew up, you know, the Hail Mary plays, like, you know, or I don't know, but I think I like how just level headed you are about things and just how you don't hype stuff up. You acknowledge the risks, you let people know how to minimize them, show them the worst case scenarios where it doesn't have to be scary to get started. So I'm excited for people to check out your Coach Carson podcast and just get involved in real estate in general, or that other thing that you want to get involved with. If it's not real estate, maybe you listen to this, you're like, sounds like a lot of work. Sounds like you need to be a real specialist. Like, great, stick with index funds. That's what I've done. So really thank you for being on the show, Chad. And you didn't ask me to say this, we're not earning any money for saying this, but you also have a fantastic real estate investor course for beginners that comes out, what, every 6 months?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for the compliments. I need to get you as a help me marketing my business a little bit. I don't do enough of that.
The main reason, you know, no money was exchanged here. You know, this is me having Chad on the show because I think he does a great job of like talking to that beginner, that five-figure income family, that person that wants to get their taxable income down, right? So yeah, so just know that he's got a bunch of free stuff if you're into real estate, as well as not expensive options to learn more with paid stuff if you want it.
And I will say about the course is it's my way to be able to connect with people more on a small, kind of local or a personalized basis. So, like on the podcast, on YouTube channel, it's great. You passively learn. What I do with the course, that's essentially my coaching. I don't do any one-on-one coaching anymore, any consulting. And so what I do is I have these courses twice per year. They're open, close. You go through the course with a group, what it's called Real Estate Deal School. And it's all about putting deals together. How do you find them? How do you finance them? How do you analyze the market? How do you ultimately close on these properties? How do you find the good deals? I kind of hold your hand and take you through that with a community of people. And then you can repeat that course as many times as you want. So I have a lot of busy people. They get halfway through the course and things fall apart. And then they do it again in the spring. So it's become a big community of people who are all interested in this style of real estate investing, not trying to buy 1,000 units, just buying your small and mighty portfolio, but learning how to do it correctly, learning the fundamentals, and then helping other people out doing it. That's really what it's all about.
That makes a ton of sense to me. If you're thinking seriously about buying your first rental property, is get the education, get the background that you need first before taking that $200,000 or more risk so that you know that you can feel confident in the numbers. Chad, thank you so much. I hope that people get started investing before these student loan payments start up again, so we lock down some good long-term deals, that extra cash flow people have for the next few months.
Thanks, Travis. Really appreciate you having me on.